about 4:10 in the morning, my grandmother Givens, who had beautiful red hair in my opinion, was very much afraid that the grandchildren would show up with red hair. I do not know why she was so scared of red hair. The oldest grandchild was a granddaughter and did not have red hair. I, being the second grandchild, she worried and for several weeks writing my folks demanding a lock of my hair to prove that I was not red-haired. According to all stories that I have heard, I was as bald as a billiard cue ball was the reason that they did not send my grandmother a lock of my hair as she was kept writing for, and she was believing that they were delaying because I had red hair. After a few weeks, my father clipped and got enough fuzz and hair to prove that I was not. He laid it on a piece of paper to wrap it up and breathed too hard and it all disappeared. So they had to wait a few more weeks then until enough hair grew out to prove to send to her to prove that I was not red-haired. I was not told about any other happenings until December the 8th, or thereabouts, in 1908, just before I was 2 years old. At that time, my father read an advertisement in a farm paper of a man in Kansas wanting someone to come there and operate his wheat farm after he'd had a heart attack and was told by his doctors to take it easy for some time. His son, who was to take over the farm, was a junior in Kansas State College at Manhattan, Kansas, and was not ready to come home yet. My father, apparently tired of the long, hard winters and small farming in Iowa, wrote the man asking him or telling him that he would come and take over for him if he so desired. In his letter, he explained to the man that he had some horses, some farm implements, and a house full of furniture and didn't want to dispose of all of it. The man wrote back and said, "Come on, bring everything. As I have a small farm adjacent to my large one, and there's no one living on it now, and you can move in to that farm, farm it when you're not taking care of my wheat farm." So, the day after Christmas in 1908, my father loaded most of the stuff on the freight car and headed for south central Kansas at Isabel, where my mother and I stayed while he was down there getting things set up. I was never told, I do not know. We climbed on a passenger train on the 5th day of January 1909 and headed for the state of Kansas at the town of Isabel. We arrived in Isabel at high noon on January the 6th, 1909, which happened to be my second birthday. Arriving in Isabel was the first recollection I have of in my childhood. I knew it was approaching dinner time, and I was getting hungry, and was asking my mother when we were going to eat. She said, "We will meet your father and Isabel in a short while, and he will provide us with something to eat when we get there." In a short time, the train pulled into the station at Isabel, and I, looking out the window, saw my father standing on the porch or platform of the railroad depot. To me, it was a porch. I thought, how come a passenger train is arriving in a town at noon when it is time to eat? That is most unusual, I thought, and worried about that for many years. As I grew older, I wondered why I thought that arriving in a town on a passenger train was so unusual to be arriving at noon. Many years later, I think I was in high school at the time, we were visiting some people, the man being a doctor, and we got talking about early memories, and I mentioned the fact of thinking that a passenger train arriving in a station at noon was very unusual. My father said, "Well, I don't think you can remember that. That was just your second birthday." I said, "Well, I can remember it." He had never mentioned that to me, and later my mother said she never had. But this doctor says, where you lived in Iowa, did a train go by there, and at what time? My father thought a little bit and says, "Yes, passenger train went by about a quarter of a mile from our house, and that it always stopped at a little station we could see from our place, and it was always after dark." The doctor then says, "Well, in his opinion, the only time a passenger train was supposed to get to any place was after dark." We got off of the train, and my father took us to a cafe run by a young couple by the name of Berger, whose parents lived on a farm not far from where we were going to live. And they really fed me as royally as anybody could, as my father said that I was extremely hungry, and also that it was my 2-year-old birthday. The house we moved into there in Kansas on this small farm adjacent to the large farm of the man that my dad was running it for, was an old-fashioned, very high-ceilinged house. I think the ceilings were about 12 feet. It was two stories, and there was a stairway up one side of it to the second floor. The stairway was quite steep, and my next recollection was coming down to breakfast one morning. I slipped at the top step and rolled down the entire stairway. For several days, I was bruised and bumped, and my folks were extremely glad that I hadn't hurt myself any worse, so my next recollection of Kansas was about 3 months before we left there. We were moved over into the house on the big farm as the man and his wife had decided to take a small vacation, and their daughter, who I think was about 17 at the time and was going to high school, stayed there, and my folks lived at the place and helped take care of her, as well as chores had to be done on the around the farmhouse. My last recollection of Kansas happened during this time. I presume it must have been Saturday, as the daughter was not at school that day, and it was rather hot. The sun was shining very brightly. Anyway, my mother had put me down for a nap, and I woke up, found that she and the daughter were both taking a nap, and there was nobody to go to play with, have them read to me or anything like that. So I decided to go to the Burger's house, which didn't seem very far when we were riding, but it turned out it was 3 miles, and I walked the distance for a then little over 3-year-old boy. 3-mile walk was quite a walk. And after I'd got started and been gone a while, I thought maybe I'd made a mistake because the place didn't seem to be getting any closer. However, I went on, arrived at the Burger's house, and Mrs. Burger met me at the door and said, "What are you doing here?" I said, "I come to play." She says, "Does your mother know you're here?" I said, "I don't think so. She's asleep." She took me in. She tried to call the house. No answer. She rang and rang on the old party line telephone, but no answer. So she kept trying every little bit. I, being dressed in a little old sunsuit, was rather sunburned. She doped me up with some anti-sunburn cream or something so that I wouldn't get too sick. And kept trying, and finally my mother answered the phone and was greatly relieved to find out where I was. And she said that made it very emphatic that I was never to go any place without letting her know before I went that I was going. I remembered that for years. Was crying when she told me that, so that was the worst punishment I could have had for that deal, and I always remembered it. Remember it to this day, and I never go any place that I don't tell somebody where I'm going. Sometime early in July, I was told that we were moving to No Man's Land in Oklahoma. I wondered about No Man's Land, but I didn't know the history of it, and my mother didn't want to go into the thing right then, trying to explain it to a 3.5-year-old boy. My father loaded all of our possessions, including horses and a cow and a wagon and household furniture and a few farm implements, into a boxcar and headed for Englewood, Kansas, which was the end of the railroad. I found out much later that it was 35 miles from Englewood to the place where we were going in Beaver County, Oklahoma, which was the first county in what was still known then as No Man's Land. 2 days later, my mother and I crawled on the train again and headed for Englewood, Kansas ourselves. Arriving there, my father again met us at the train with a wagon and horses, and our old buggy mare, Jenny, hitched to the buggy, into which we got and headed with the rest of our furniture on the wagon for the claim, which by that time I found out we were going to. I didn't know what a claim was either. Years later, when I asked my dad what a claim was, he said that was where you bet the government $14.06 you could live on 160 acres of land without starving to death. There was times during the 5 years that I was convinced that we weren't going to make it without starving to death. We didn't make the 35 miles that first day. Where we stayed that night, I have no idea where we stayed or what we did to spend the night. I imagine we camped along the road someplace. About the middle of the next afternoon, we arrived, came around the hill, and there I saw a house and a barn. And my mother says, there's where we're going to live. I remember quite vividly that I was not going to live there. It was an impossibility to live there because when she asked me why I wasn't going to live there, I says there's no windmill and I can't get a drink of water anytime I want to. She assured me that shortly we would have a windmill. We arrived at the house, went in, some of the furniture that my father had brought down on the previous trip was already sitting in the house. And I started looking around in it, and a big old bumblebee came from someplace and landed on the back of my hand. I was wearing one of those old-fashioned little Lord Fauntleroy shirtwaists with not too loose of cuffs and big puffy sleeves. I made a hit at the bumblebee on the back of my hand, and he went up under my sleeve, under my cuff, up into my arm, and there stung. I made a swat at him, and he went farther up towards my shoulder, and there he stung again. That time I grabbed him and squeezed him, and I was ready to leave Oklahoma and go back to Kansas or any place where I wouldn't be running into bumblebees like that. The well was drilled, and over it was a little A-frame with a pulley hanging in the top and a bucket, which was a long piece of very light pipe with a valve at the bottom of it that let the bucket down on a rope to into the well, and the bucket would fill up as it went underwater. We'd haul it back up, and that was the way we had to get our water for about a month until we got a windmill and got it up. That was the height of my glory. Then I could get a drink any time that I wanted to with the windmill running. Late in September, there was quite a bustle around our house. A woman that lived not far from us, who was called an old maid, moved in to our house, and my mother told me that I was to mind her just the same as I did would her. The house was a three-room affair, living dining room, one bedroom, and a lean-to kitchen. The bedroom, my folks strung a canvas through the middle of it and had their bed on one side and mine on the other. On September, the evening of the September of the 25th, I was moved out into the little lean-to kitchen, and I didn't know why. Nobody would tell me why, except that they was expecting a visitor. Early the next morning, I heard what sounded like a baby crying. It turned out to be a brother had arrived. Then came the job of choosing names. I went for George as one of the burger boys in Kansas that was a good friend of mine. It was named George, and I thought that was the height of names. My mother had a brother by the name of George, so she also wanted the name of Howard in there because that was one of her good students when she was teaching school in Kay County, Oklahoma Territory. So my brother came up with the name of George Howard Givens. Christmas came along. I knew that where we were living, Santa Claus would just not find the place. It would be impossible for him to find that lonely spot out in the corner of three big ranches. However, a day or two before Christmas, a package from the man in Kansas arrived, and in it was a wind-up automobile. The first one that I had ever seen, the first one my dad had ever seen, to have in his hands at least. On Christmas Day, one of the ranchers of the that was in we were in the corner of came in and spent the day. He and his wife came and spent the day with us Christmas Day, and he and my father practically wore that little wind-up automobile out, running it around on the dining room floor there all day Christmas Day. And I can remember that man saying, "Someday I'm going to have me one of those things." He did, of course. He became a banker in county seat, town of Beaver City, later on. And a number of years after I was well grown, he was in a automobile accident and was permanently crippled from it. He had to walk with crutches. Christmas morning, I'd hung my stockings up Christmas Eve, so if Santa Claus did happen to find the place, I'd have been prepared for him. And I got up early Christmas morning and went out to see if maybe he had. Well, in my stocking was an orange and a banana, a little sack of candy, and on the broom handle across two chairs, which I'd hung the stocking on, was a pair of blue denim shirt and a pair of overalls, which on a tag on them said, "Fits like father's." That didn't mean a lot to me then, as they read it to me. Because it didn't fit my father like it fit me, couldn't possibly. However, Fitz was spelled F-I-T-Z. I left the shirt and the overall and the little car and Kansas had sent to my town for my brother was a little woolly rabbit with a rubber bulb on it. You'd press the bulb and he'd hop. Play with it to show my of our fuel was cow chips, which you'd go out on the prairie and gather, particularly around where they fed the cows, cottonseed oil cake. And as fuel, it made a good fire if somebody stood and stoked it every little bit. We also burned from Capricorn pummies, which was the Capricorn thrashed, and that's what came out the blower on the thrash machine, which held the grain in the head when it was growing. It wasn't quite as good a fuel as the cow chips were. We did have a few hunks of coal that we would use when company was there, and on exceptionally real cold days. In the summer of 1911 passed without much happening that I can remember. The only one thing I do remember, however, is that somebody had left a ladder up against the windmill tower, and I got up on the platform of the windmill and was pulling it out of the wind and swinging out on the fan as it jerked back into the wind. And I was having a great time when Mother came out to see what I was doing and saw me, and did she ream me out. She promised not to whoop me if I'd come down, so I came down, but she told me never to get up on that windmill again. That was a dangerous place for kids. And when my father came home, he said the next time if I ever got up on that windmill, I would get a tannin that I would remember the rest of my life. So I never crawled up on that windmill again at an early age. In August 1911, my mother went to the county seat and took the county teacher's examination. Decided she would help out with the living expenses a little by teaching school. There was a little school known as Sage District 85, about 3 miles from us, and she got the job of teaching that school, one room, all grades, up through the eighth. The old maid came in and lived in our house and took care of George and I while she was away at teaching school. As I remember, the school lasted 6 months. The winter of 1911 and 12 turned out to be an exceptionally bad winter for that area. The snow was deep and on the ground all winter long, and the ranchers had trouble of feeding their cattle, and thousands of them died in storms in the whole county. Quite a number of days my mother could not get to the school to teach. The students couldn't have got there anyway, so they just called it off during those blizzards. One family that lived about 3 miles from us for quite a while, they were our closest neighbors. There was 12 children in that family, and four of the younger children went to school with my mother. They were all quite brilliant students, and the family became very good friends of ours. And there was one girl that was, I think, 6 days difference in her age and my age. During the summer of 1912, a family moved in onto a claim west of us and had a house that was, not quite a half a mile from ours. I had three boys. It was Ernest and James and Luther. Luther was the oldest, about 16. Ernest was a couple years older than I was. These three boys all needed to go to school, and they decided that they would drive an old mule they had to a buggy spring wagon that we had, and I would ride with them to the Sage School, which was going to be taught by one of the young ladies of the family I spoke about, that four of the children had gone to school to my mother. This young lady was probably in the neighborhood of 20 years old at the time. My mother had taught me to count and and taught me the alphabet, and I could read some small sentences. So I was placed in the first grade instead of what then was known as the primary or the starting grade. And the school was going to last 6 months. However, after 3 months, these people, the three boys, decided that claim life wasn't for them, and they moved away. And that finished my schooling for that year, because 3 miles down through the pastures and whatnot were too far for a not yet quite six-year-old boy to make and by himself. And my father, working for the ranches part of the time, they could not always take me in there, neither could my mother. So my school ended at that time for that year. During the summer of 1913,